From the American Tobacco Historic District, this is The State of Things. I'm Melinda Penn-Cava. And on this All Hallows Eve, we pause to consider the other side. Across the state, graveyards can be found in churchyards, even in a few backyards. But wherever they may be, cemeteries mark the end of lives and eras. There are stories behind and below those gravestones of winters too harsh for early settlers or lives lost on battlefields over the centuries of wars. And the cemeteries themselves offer clues of past cultures in North Carolina. June Haddon Hobbs is a professor at Gardner-Webb University, and she studies gravestones and epitaphs and joins us on this Halloween. Thanks for being with us today.
Hi, it's a pleasure to be here.
Hi. Well, June Haddon Hobbs, you talk about reading cemeteries.
Mm-hmm.
What are the kind of things that that we should look for in them that we can pick up from a cemetery?
Well, one of the things that I would look for when I went into a cemetery is how are the gravestones arranged. If they are in a grid-type pattern, like you'll find in most churchyards, you know that you've got a cemetery that was founded perhaps in the 18th or 19th century when graveyards were a matter-of-fact sort of thing. You had to keep order in your community and in agrarian societies. They were planted pretty much like crops were. Later, after the middle of the 19th century, when the rural cemetery movement began to have an important effect on American cemeteries, you will have graves that will be scattered about with lots of curving roads and an invitation to come and seek repose in the cemetery. They were deeply influenced by the Romantic movement. And then if you have a 20th century cemetery, you're likely to have graves arranged for maximum efficiency on the Memorial Park model, and those cemeteries will be supporting different kinds of values, efficiency, more comfort for the viewer, you don't think of death, and so forth.
Mm, and the Memorial Park, are you talking those that may not have gravestones that stand up, so
right.
It looks like one big hillside?
Right. That's exactly right. They will be, they're arranged so that the caretakers can easily mow them, but there's a different reason, too, that is maybe not so obvious. Those Memorial Parks were sort of the darlings of the cemetery professionals who began to arise toward the beginning of the 20th century, and they felt like death should not be an obvious thing. It should be a more natural thing so that you don't think about it. They had a more, shall we say, species view of humanity. You know, people go on, but individual deaths are not so important. You should break away from your dead.
So a question about the real estate involved here.
Sure.
Does this mean that the grave sites are much closer together? There is not, shall we say, more as much elbow room as there might have been in older cemeteries?
Sure, because in a memorial park, the major value is efficiency. You're going to put your graves in all kinds of different ways. They'll be oriented north, south, east, west, all sorts of different ways. But in older cemeteries, if it's in an area that's predominantly Christian, they're going to be in an east-west orientation.
Mm. So talk to me a bit about the east-west. It was a matter of wanting to face the east. What exactly is behind that?
Well, there are several different theories. One is that it is a very old custom, that the idea is that the person is buried with his or her feet to the east and head to the west so that they would rise facing the rising sun. But I think a more satisfying answer for me is that this is a matter of the Christianity of the people who buried these people, because there are scriptures. One is in Matthew 24:27 that suggests that the risen Lord will appear in the east. So the idea is that on Judgment Day you want to rise so that you're facing the risen Lord and, you know, can go directly into heaven.
Hmm. Does that follow through to this day? Are there cemeteries that are oriented in that manner where they would have the gravestones facing the east?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Most traditional churchyards, which, of course, are in many cases still working cemeteries, municipal cemeteries are often like that. The places where that will not be as obvious would be in memorial parks where, as I said, the prevailing cultural value is efficiency.
Mm-hmm. But without any headstones, there wouldn't be anything to block one's view, one would presume.
Well, true, but the idea is that the body itself is oriented in a traditional cemetery so that the body could supposedly rise from the feet up.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And well, we just mentioned that memorial parks maybe not have as many gravestones as before, but that is often what many people associate with the old cemeteries. And I have a question for you. Years ago, I think it was in Beaufort, I saw a gravestone because I like going to old cemeteries mm-hmm. when I'm in towns. And there was this epitaph on it, or at least just the woman's name, and it said that she was the consort mm-hmm. of somebody. And I believe this might have been in the 1700s or so was
right.
the date of birth and death. We're in that century. What precisely was a consort, and has that definition changed over time?
Sure. A consort simply means a spouse. And so you can have a consort who is male or consort who is female. The problem is that that word now has something rather illicit connotation attached to it. We think of the consort as someone who is perhaps a mistress but not truly married. But in earlier days, the word simply meant spouse, and you'll see it on all kinds of tombstones.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. There are slave grave sites in North Carolina, of mm-hmm. course. How are they different from the other grave sites of that era? Of course, they would have, I'm presuming they would have been separate from white cemeteries.
Mm-hmm.
How would they, is there anything else about them that, you know, would mark those grave sites as slave graves?
I have not seen a lot of gravestones on slave graves. When there are gravestones erected, they were frequently erected by the master because the slaves themselves did not have the means to mark graves. Sometimes graves were marked with wooden markers that have long since deteriorated and are not there anymore. Sometimes there is a tradition of marking slave graves or just African-American graves with different kinds of goods. For example, shells are popular, using a scraped earth kind of marking, which means that you scrape off the topsoil so that nothing actually grows on the grave is a possibility. I think really the most interesting thing, though, about slave graves is how many cemeteries I've been to where someone has told me, you see that place over there where there aren't any markers? That's where the slaves were buried. They often have very little evidence, but I think it is an indication of people's discomfort with the fact that slave graves are often not marked at all.
Hmm. I've seen, it was in Georgia once, mm-hmm. a section of a cemetery, and mm-hmm. it would have been, I think, after the Civil War, perhaps, and there were links of chain that mm-hmm. would indicate one link was if that person had been born a slave, the second one if they had lived as a slave, and the third if they had died as a slave, and so there would be some with three links and some with two.
I haven't seen that particular icon.
Yeah.
You should probably make sure that you're not mixing it up with the logo for the International Order of Odd Fellows, which is three links.
Okay.
One of the things that frequently appears on gravestones, particularly through maybe the middle of the 20th century, is the symbol of a fraternal organization, Masons, for example. And that's one that you'd often have. But I that's not to say that didn't happen, but I haven't seen that.
Right, right. Do you have a favorite North Carolina graveyard?
Oh, I have a number of favorite graveyards. I never met a graveyard I didn't like. A couple that I am very fond of is Oakdale in Hendersonville, which is the place that has the little gravestone that has my favorite epitaph on it. It seemed like a good idea at the time. I'm not sure exactly what that's supposed to mean. And it's also where the Thomas Wolfe Angel is located. Another favorite of mine is Sunset Cemetery in Shelby, North Carolina, which is about 6 or 7 miles from where I live. I love that one because it represents so many different kinds of cemeteries. It started out as a family cemetery, so there are some old graves laid out in a grid pattern, and then evolved after it was turned into a municipal cemetery in 1841. Into a garden style or rural style cemetery following the pattern established in the Northeast at places like Mount Auburn in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And then in the newer sections, it has some of the characteristics of a memorial park, Two of the things that I really love, though, is that like most garden cemeteries, in the older part, it has a didactic function. It's meant to teach you about cemeteries. So one of the things that I've found, there are some lost cause monuments. One of my favorites is for a man named Makaja Durham. I'm sitting in my office right now and looking at a rubbing that I made of his gravestone. At the bottom of that it says, "A reader of books, lover of things of the spirit, he rode horseback from Rutherford County, North Carolina to New York City and again to Charleston to hear Jenny Lind sing." And it seems to me that that's a great way of memorializing the lost cause. In the newer section, I'm always intrigued by the grave goods. In the last, 10 to 20 years maybe, there's been this great influx of gifts left for the dead on graves. I found a grave recently that had NASCAR flags and a car on the gravestone. It seems to me that sports icons are beginning to replace traditional religious symbols.
Well, June Haddon Hobbs, thank you so much for talking with us today.
It was my pleasure.
Okay, and happy Halloween to you.
Same to you.
June Haddon Hobbs is a professor of English at Gardner Webb University in Shelby. And just ahead, we'll be talking with author Sarah Hall, who splits her time between England and North Carolina. Her latest novel is The Electric Michelangelo. That's all coming up on The State of Things. And you're listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.